which regions were affected. Do the outbreaks come randomly, or is there a pattern to it? Asked Tungil. He had hardly touched his food, and Ireheart was sure he seemed much paler than usual. He studied the map they showed him, concentrating hard. We couldn't find any pattern to it, answered Belindis. We got the Freelings to search the places where the highest mortality had occurred, to see if maybe the Alfar were targeting us, but no traces were found, and those who were part of the Freelings expedition all fell ill a few orbits later. They died. How? Asked the one-eyed dwarf. They suffocated in their own blood. First they grew feverish, and then their lungs filled with blood until they could not breathe. She shuddered. An appalling death, Tungdil. He pushed the map away and emptied his tankard, the seventh, if Ireheart had not lost count. A considerable amount for a dwarf who had not eaten anything much. Heroic achievement. Did their limbs change colour? Perhaps the tips of their fingers? What about their tongues? Belindis and her son exchanged glances. I didn't tell him, said Balindar. Nobody knows. Tungdil shot him a dangerous smile. I don't need to be told. I worked it out for myself. He summoned a fresh tankard. It's not a curse. It's an odorless gas. Balindar rolled his eyes. No, it's not. We rule that out. The methods for investigating the conventional humours exuded by the mountain are useless with this problem, Balindar. It's the Cordrian. In countless ways, it's been responsible for the deaths in the Grey Range. It doesn't just eat those who confront it. Its excrement is lethal as well, causing the painful death Belindis has just described as soon as it meets water. He took the map in his hand. Ireheart told me that the Cordrian is in the northern part of the Grey Mountains, near the Stone Gateway. That's your explanation. Rainwater washes the excrement down the slopes, and it runs into the rivers that feed the canals, being washed down to the parts of the mountain where the so-called fever turns up. Even its shit is murderous, exclaimed Ireheart in disbelief. That's what I call a really devious monster. Good thing we're going to get rid of him. We aren't going to. It will be Lot Ionan. He put the next full tankard to his lips and took a long draught. I think it will take a cycle or two until the toxic effect fades away, so that you can return to those regions. He saw that Balindar did not believe him. It is something to do with alchemy, Steelfinger, he explained. I grew up in the house and laboratories of a Magus. The composition of the Cordrian's excrement is unique, if you like, a kind of dried acid. As soon as it comes into contact with water, the substances mix and a lethal gas is released. I used this several times on the other side of the Black Abyss if a siege wasn't going well. He finished his drink. I don't give your sick dwarves much of a chance. The lungs won't recover from the acid burns. They're for the eternal smithy. I believe you, said Belindis, pale now. She indicated where the Cordrian was thought to have its eyrie. Vrakas was good to us, and we have always been able to destroy the soft eggs before they hatch. Our scouts report, though, that it's back in the nest and that the Cordrian has learned to keep supplies. If we're out of luck, it won't have to leave the clutch of eggs to get food. That was always our opportunity to make a move. We'll think up a suitable diversion, Ireheart said confidently. Right, scholar? We go to the nest, grab the eggs, and run off through the Grey Range all the way to the entrance to Goragar? No. We must go over the summits, so that it can follow our tracks. I've worked out a route. Balindar's eyes widened. In winter? Are you out of your mind? After a pause, he added, High King? Without hesitating, Tungdil recited the names of the summits they would have to cross, specifying places they would rest. Does that still sound like madness to you? He asked cuttingly. or more like a demanding but achievable journey? Belindis nodded. I'm amazed how much you still remember about my homeland, when there are so many other things you have forgotten. It was a snide remark, but one she couldn't resist making. It seems your mind has concentrated on the scholarly side of your nature and eliminated all feeling. Is that how it is, High King? Tungdil turned his brown eye toward her. That may indeed be so, Queen Belindis. But it will help us and Gerdlegard. I shan't be complaining.
Nor me, announced Ironheart,
still digesting the details of his friend's strategy. Throughout the whole of the journey so far, he had not once seen Tungdil consult a map. His knowledge must be vast.
I suggest we set off as soon as possible, before the wretched things hatch out.
Tomorrow, as soon as the sun is up, said Tungdil, getting to his feet. I would like to rest. Queen Belindis, be good enough to have me shown to my chambers. And tomorrow my ponies must be fresh and ready. And we'll need provisions. Please arrange that. She signaled to one of the dwarves to accompany the ruler of all the dwarf tribes, and Tungdil left the throne room without even bidding farewell. Slynn and the Fourthlings withdrew, leaving Belindis and her son alone with Boindil. They carried on eating in silence and later avoided any mention of Tungdil while they discussed such topics as the Black Abyss and the dangers facing Gerdlegard. Ironheart, however, was well aware they couldn't skirt round the issue forever, and, fed up with having constantly to defend the scholar to others, he eventually took a quick draught of beer and broached the subject of his friend himself.
It may be that I'm mistaken, Belindis, but there's a strong resemblance between Tungdil and your son.
He realized that the question was out of order, potentially problematic and possibly insulting. He was implying that she had deceived her husband, Glaimbar Sharpax of the clan of the Ironbeaters and the king of the Fifthlings, passing off another's child as his son. But Belindis took his words with equanimity, relieved almost that it had been mentioned. It is very obvious, isn't it? She said softly. It was a mistake to send Balindar to the meeting in the Brown Mountains. All the clan leaders have seen him and his real father together, and will have put two and two together.
Will this affect your regency, do you think?
She shook her head. No one is after my throne. Now that Jeroen Leddenring is dead from the fever. He was the brother of Sindalis Leddenring, the king's second wife. She was rejected in favor of me. Jeroen and some of his clan never forgave me for that. I rule well, though, and if the Cordrian can be driven off, the tribe of the Fifthlings will flourish. Belindis started to cough.
I had forgotten you were unwell, said Ironheart in concern.
It will get better, now that we know what the cause of the fever and lung disease is.
We have found the guilty party, but we haven't found a cure.
Ironheart tried to shut out from his mind the explanation the scholar had given, in particular those words concerning the inevitable death of the sufferer.
But we're sure to find something to make it better,
he hastened to say. He felt gloomy.
Pull yourself together. She's not dead yet.
The queen sighed. Glaimbar knew.
What? That Balindar was not his son?
Yes. He never said so, but I could read his expression. He did not voice his suspicions or reject Balindar. That was his greatness of heart. I loved him for that generosity. She gave a pained smile. Balindar will succeed to the Fifthling throne after me, Ironheart. That's what Glaimbar wanted, too, because he saw what a splendid ruler he will be one day.
But he does not get on with his real father.
Ironheart dusted a few crumbs off his beard, which had somehow trailed in his plate of food.
And he has a fair idea of who it is he's dealing with. I mean, he's not blind. He must have noticed the similarity.
That could be the reason Balindar doesn't like him. He doesn't want to be the son of Tungdil Goldhand, a complete stranger, rather than of Glaimbar, whom he admired. Glaimbar taught him to fight, and I taught him the work of a smith. Tungdil didn't always come off particularly well when I told stories of him, if you take my meaning. After he ended our relationship in a letter, I was angry and disappointed in him for a long time. Age has made me milder. She closed her eyes. But when I saw him standing in front of me again, Ironheart, all the old feelings came back.
So you are convinced he really is Tungdil?
He bit his tongue. Too late. To his surprise, Belinda smiled. Don't be confused by the somber exterior. My heart, here she placed her hand on her breast, my heart recognized him at once. It has never misled me.
It was the same for me, he replied.
He lifted his tankard. Chapter 11. Girdlegard, former queendom of Wayern, island of Lake Pride, late winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. Lake Pride was easy to defend against attack, because the island rose high above the lake, meaning its soldiers needed no special equipment for hurling rocks. Simply rolling boulders over the edge would sink a ship. Structural improvements had been made to the shaft around the magic source, with men and materials carried on cables whizzing to and fro above the lake. Millennia and Radario were observing the works from a vantage point on the watchtower battlements. Queen Wei and her daughter Koira had ordered extensive preparations, anticipating an attack by the dragon or his henchmen, the Lohasbranders. "What you can see there is not the most powerful weapon against the dragon," said Radario. "You mean the queen and her daughter?" Millennia looked down into the courtyard of the palace 30 paces below. The figures looked tiny. "You say they've both attained their full magic potency?" "I've been told the queen has bathed in the magic source. The gods only know how she managed to preserve the remnants of her force for her escape. But as a result, she's thought to be stronger than Lotionen. I'm sure Lohasbran will think twice before he attacks her." He stepped in front of Millennia to look into her eyes. "And that's not to say he actually will attack. I think he'll swallow the bait about Alfar's spies in his realm. Dragons are paranoid and always suspicious someone is after their treasure." Millennia laughed. "So you're not just an actor. You're a dragon specialist?" She smiled and took his chin in her hand. "A man of many parts, Radario the Seventh. If you had muscles as well, you'd be a real man." He made a face and took his scrawny beard out of harm's way, but he did enjoy it when she teased him. "I take it as a sign of hidden affection when you insult me. You're sounding me out," he replied. "Oh, so that's what you think." "Sweet dreamer, dream on. My affection consists of wanting to protect you, like protecting a child. So vulnerable, so clumsy." Like lightning, he drew one of her own short swords. "You should be proud of yourself, Millennia. Now you've managed to provoke me," he threatened. "On guard!" She drew the other sword and went along with the joke. "Then attack me, number seven. Why don't you show this weak woman where her place is?" The muscles in her arm and chest rippled with the exertion. They were certainly stronger than his own. Radario made an obvious move to hit her, and she caught his wrist to stay his hand. Then she gave him a kiss on the brow. "How funny," she mocked, pushing him back. "Try again, little man." Apparently furious now, he hopped toward her, tripping over his mantle. He stumbled past her, heading for the parapet. When Millennia grabbed him to stop him plunging over the top, her fingers met thin air. But her mouth met a kiss. His lips were soft and pleasing on her own. There was a faint taste of the spiced tea he had drunk to warm him. Then he drew his head back and left her blushing. "A hit?" he insulted, waving his weapon in the air. That took you by surprise, didn't it, brave warrior woman? I won. The kiss is mightier than the sword.
Melania swallowed hard. She was confused, still feeling the audacious embrace and not knowing how to react. It was an incredible invasion of her person, impudence that must be punished.
Rodario saw that she was visibly shaken. Oh, I didn't mean to embarrass you, he stuttered. It was a game, and then you'd kissed me on the forehead, so a game indeed.
She held her hand out, demanding her short sword, which he relinquished at once.
Let's forget it. You won, and you won't get a second chance.
He cleared his throat. Forgive me. I got carried away. I offer my sincere apologies. I should never have done that. He bowed.
Hit me if you want.
So that you can dodge out of the way and kiss me again?
No thanks, Rodario the Seventh, Melania said, stowing her weapons. Let's leave it at that.
She tried hard to treat the incident lightly, but found it all very unsettling. It was a feeling she hated. She marched off to the edge of the platform and stared out, admiring the beauty of the lake, but with her thoughts in turmoil.
It was only a stolen kiss, she told herself, a child's kiss. How can he make me feel like this?
Rodario, Melania, are you up there?
Koira's voice echoed up the stairwell.
Yes, Princess, we're admiring the view and keeping watch for Wayan's enemies, the actor answered. What can we do for you?
Come down here, came a cheerful instruction. I've got important news for Melania.
Rodario and the swordswoman hurried down the steps to join Koira, who was coming up to meet them.
My mother received a message from one of the neighboring villages, she said,
her eyes fixed onto Melania's injured arm.
Remind me to check that bandage. We can take it off tomorrow. The wound should be healing well by now, and will benefit from the exposure to air and sunlight.
Is it good news or bad? Rodario urged.
I don't know. My mother just sent for me. Let's go and find out.
They hastened through the palace, through high, sunlit corridors and anterooms until they reached the place where they had first seen the monarch. The window had been repaired, and the view of waves glittering in the sun, birds circling and colourful fishing boats bobbing on the water, had lost none of its fascination. Queen Wei sat behind her desk. Her turquoise robes suited her splendidly, and she looked well. But worry was etched on her features.
Sit down, she said to her guests. There are things to report.
Has something happened in Eidos Lane, ma'am?
Asked Melania, taking her seat.
No. In Solheim, a village near here. A fisherman tells me he saw two Alfar locally, said the queen. What troubles me is that he is the only one to have seen them. The other villagers are keeping silent. They are afraid. I'm sure the Alfar are hiding there, waiting for their chance.
She looked at Melania. The chance to get to Lake Pride and kill you.
Then let me follow it up, mother, Koira suggested at once. They can't hurt me.
You can't stop an assassin's arrow, my child, replied Wei. You took them by surprise at the shore, but now they know who their opponent is. The Alfar will avoid showing themselves in the daytime. She looked at Melania.
I think we should give them an opportunity to find a way in, an opportunity that we control.
In other words, a trap, said Rodario, delighted at the idea. Your Majesty, that is an absolutely excellent plan.
Why, thank you for your support, sir, she retorted, highly amused.
The fisherman who came to speak to me about the Alfar is going to spread a couple of rumours in the village to attract the attention of the Black Eyes. They'll say that our guards are all stricken with the runs and can't leave their beds.
Who else knows you are now free of your chains, Your Majesty?
Melania was too alarmed to sit still. She had not yet escaped the shadow of death.
The Alfar won't come if they think they'll have to contend with two Magi in order to kill me.
No one knows apart from my most loyal servants.
And what will the dragon say? Objected Rodario.
Is he coming? I thought I noticed a lot of activity on the battlements out by the magic source.
Wei looked at him steadily.
Do you know what, Rodario the Seventh? Sometimes you seem a bit strange, she said. We have an actor here who plays so many roles that he has forgotten where the real Rodario is.
Rodario went red.
I don't understand what you mean. I've been watching you. Sometimes you are very bold, my daughter tells me. Then you're awkward, then swift and nimble. Sometimes you have a way with words, and at other times you stammer and stutter. You have good manners one moment and forget them the next. Like just now, when you dared to interrupt a queen.
She rubbed her temple as if she had a headache.
I don't think there is anything magic about you to explain this away. But your mind is, to put it mildly, confused. Am I right?
Millennia thought of the incident on the battlements and secretly felt she had to agree with the queen.
I apologize, your majesty, he said contritely,
making a deep bow in front of the queen.
Of course you are right. I should have waited.
To return to the question, Rodario the Impatient, Queen Wei continued in a gentler tone of voice. I must tell you that the dragon has not yet sent an answer, and I am certain that he would be convinced by the nightmare cadaver and the corpses of his people. She turned to Millennia. But your concerns have priority. I don't like having the Alfar near at hand. The Solheim fisherman will be returning to his village to spread those rumors. Then we will have to wait and pretend we are all ill with diarrhea. My guards have been told what's happening. Koya will explain our plans. I have work to do. She glanced pointedly at the door. The three needed no more explicit hint and left the room. The princess took them to her apartments, where they continued their discussion over tea and cake.
It's simple, said Koira. The Alfar will find one of our guards and ask him about you, Millennia. You wait in your chamber with me. When the Alfar come, I'll show them that it would be better if they left.
You sound very confident.
Rodario held a cup and a piece of cake in his hands.
Like your mother said, don't you think they expect to find you?
Koira laughed.
What can they do, faced with a ball of pure magic?
Dodge, he suggested, earning himself Millennia's laughter. He was reveling in the proximity of these two young women.
Such a shame he would have to split himself in two in order to continue enjoying the company of both.
Alfar are as quick as a bolt of lightning and agile as a cat. Had you thought of that?
The princess made a sound to indicate her displeasure.
Stop complaining. It's a simple plan and therefore an excellent one.
Rodario bit into his cake and made a great show of chewing.
And what's plan B? He mumbled through the crumbs. What if brother and sister Alf get past you? Who's going to save you?
He pointed to Koira with the pastry.
Who'll save you when it all goes wrong?
You will, teased Millennia. At least, it sounds like you're volunteering. If my kisses have a paralyzing effect on the Alfar, as they do on you, why not, he countered. But I'd only be dealing with the female Alf. You'll have to tackle the brother. He slurped his tea noisily. Koira stared first at him and then at Millennia, whose blushes showed that Rodario had not been lying.
You can have a try when the time comes, she said, without asking for further details.
I would prefer it if we did not kill the Alfar outright, hissed the Ido heroine venomously. At least one of them should be alive for me to interrogate.
That should be possible, Koira allowed. May I ask why?
I overheard them talking when they thought I was unconscious. I don't know if I understood aright. It is important for Gerdlegard. Millennia saw the keen curiosity in the others' faces.
I don't want to talk about it until I'm sure, she said firmly. I don't want to make the horses shy unnecessarily, as they say.
Well, that's an incentive to catch them alive, exclaimed Rodario, stuffing the rest of the cake into his mouth.
It was too late to apologize to Millennia anyway. The full moon stood high over Girdlegard and thus over Lake Pride. It was a cloudless night. The lake glinted silver, leaving the few fishing boats out seeking eels and shrimps, silhouetted like black shadows. The boats headed for the island and sailed near the shaft. One of them approached dangerously close to the stone pillar on which the island was based, so close it nearly collided. The helmsman wrenched the wheel round and skimmed past by a hair's breadth. At first sight, there was nothing suspicious in this. The currents by the island could be tricky. Even an experienced sailor could get into difficulties. For Adario, watching from his hiding place, it was proof enough that the Alfar siblings, Sisseroth and Therusha, had just set foot on land. He could not make them out yet, but that was hardly surprising. "This is it," he murmured, climbing out of the wire observation basket and hurrying up the narrow steps to the top. He raced along the coastal path and ran to the palace entrance. If Koira and Millennia had not thought out an emergency fallback plan, but were relying totally on magic, then Rodario felt it his duty to have an alternative stratagem. His ideal scenario was for him to save both girls' lives. Heroic deeds always went down well when hearts were to be won, or when hearts needed calming down. Rodario was admitted by the sentries and raced through the dark palace as quickly as he could. No one knew about his function as a secret reserve. Millennia and Koira were sitting in one room. Queen Wei was in the chamber opposite, ready to spring to her daughter's aid. Rodario had to admit that it was impossible to subdue both Magi. Even Sisseroth and Ferusha, the gods of Jon, whatever that meant, would be overcome. If Millennia had managed to kill the third sibling with one shot from her little crossbow, what would the combined magic powers of two Magi be able to achieve? But perhaps Teon might be on his creature's side that night, and then Rodario really would be needed. Rodario had reached the curtained wall niche, where he had hidden his homemade contraptions. He quickly fastened the miniature bellows filled with flash powder to his forearms. There was a flint he could activate, causing a spark to ignite the flying lycopodium seeds. A magic fireball without using magic, or at least it would be a fireball good enough to impress theatergoers. He had purchased the plan for the device for a considerable sum of money in Mifidania's marketplace. It was said originally to have been invented by the legendary Magister Technicus, but Rodario did not believe that. He did not mind who had invented it, though, as long as it worked. He had made two dry runs, and they had both been successful. "Let's see if I need you today." He pulled his sleeves down to hide the equipment, and then turned round. Right in front of him, Sisseroth appeared, smiling coldly at him. Rodario had neither heard him approach nor felt any hint of a draught. "Ye gods!" the actor breathed. The elf executed a sudden movement. Something hard hit the actor on the head, and a hot flash of lightning shot through his neck. He collapsed onto the stone floor while the elf stepped over his heavily bleeding body, making for Millennia's chamber. Millennia was in full armor as she lay under the blanket, her face turned away from the door. The small mirror on her bedside table showed her what was happening at the entrance. Pressed up close to the wardrobe and invisible from the doorway, Koira was waiting, her thoughts focused on her magic spells. She had to be in a position to cast one at a split second's notice if she was going to prevent the Alfar killing Millennia. The two women were quiet, listening for any sounds coming from the hallway or outside the chamber windows. They held their breath every time a footstep passed their door. So far, there had been no sign of the siblings. "Just so you understand, I didn't allow the actor to kiss me," Millennia suddenly whispered. "He stole the kiss." Koira had to smile. "Of course. Typical," she replied quietly. "He took me by surprise," she went on. "Next time, I'll knock him down." Koira's curiosity about affairs of the heart was awoken, in spite of the circumstances. "I'm amazed he managed to do it. What happened? Were you distracted?"
He tricked me, admitted Millennia. The weakling made a fool of me.
A faint squeak interrupted them. The catch on the door was moving slowly. They had put sand and salt in the mechanism. Millennia stared at the entrance. She could see no light under the door, so it could not have been one of the servants checking that everything was all right. They had strict instructions to carry lamps when they came. The catch stopped moving, then went slowly back into its original position.
What shall we do?
Asked Koira in a muffled voice.
We wait, Millennia hissed.
She thought it could well be Rodario on the other side. Did he want to apologize? Did he want something more of her? She sighed softly. The man was driving her crazy, as if he knew she had a thing about helpless types. The time passed painfully slowly. Everything was quiet. Whoever had been trying to enter the room must have changed their mind. Then there was a scream.
That was in Mother's room!
Koira peeled herself out of the niche, ran to the door, and pulled it open. Sisseroth stood before her, waiting with two-handed sword raised, ready to strike. The Maegar did not think twice, but sent a destructive ball of pure energy at the elf. But he dodged the sphere that was shooting toward him, just as Rodario had joked he might. The hurtling magic ball whizzed across the corridor, hitting the door 3 paces away on the other side of the passage. At that moment, Queen Wei's door swung open, and she stood on the threshold, face to face with her fate. Koira could see the fear in her mother's countenance. Horror-struck, she watched her lips move in an attempt to form a counterspell. Wei threw her arms up to protect herself, but Koira felt only utter helplessness and fear for her mother's life. Girdlegard, Dwarf Realm of the Fifthlings, in the north of the Grey Mountains, late winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. This is where the Cordrian was last cycle. Balindar studied the steep cliffs intently, searching for signs of a distant, distinctive shadow. It flies around looking for prey. If it turns up, stand tight against the rock face. The dwarf group got into pairs. The narrow ravine only allowed them to go 2 abreast. The dark grey rock walls were rough as a whetstone, and contact with anything metal caused ridges and scratches. Ironheart made use of the chance to sharpen the tip of his spike. The others took care not to scrape along the abrasive walls by accident. It would do no favors to armor, clothing, or skin. Apart from Balindar, Tungdil, Slin, and Boindil, the expedition had the 3 warriors from the Fourthling tribe with them. Belindis had sent along 5 of her Fifthlings, all of them excellent in combat. They pulled their equipment behind them on the sledges they intended to use for transporting the Cordrian's young. Tungdil stopped in the middle of the path and lifted his head, breathing in the clear, icy air. The nest, Balindar went on, will be on the southern side of the dragon's tongue. It always lays its eggs in the south. The monster digs a hole into the rock. We'll see it from quite a distance. It's like a large cave, so huge the entrance can't be concealed. After leaving the ravine, it'll take us another half orbit to get to it. We'll need another full orbit for the ascent.
What are you doing, scholar?
Ironheart wanted to know. Smelling, he said bluntly. We need to hurry. He speeded up, making for the end of the ravine. Balindar glanced at Ironheart, who shrugged in response.
Can you be a bit more specific?
Ironheart asked his friend.
I don't object to running, but I want to know why I'm having to.
The eggs are nearly ready to hatch,
Tungdil called back over his shoulder. Ironheart's own deliberately loud sniff echoed back from the walls.
Can't smell a thing!
He trotted up to his friend.
That's because you don't know what to expect. Did you notice the mossy odor?
Yes, of course.
Boindil fell silent. Then, after a moment's thought, he exclaimed,
By Vrakus! It didn't mean anything to me. I should have noticed that everything green here is covered in snow, and anything containing water frozen solid. The moss should be the same.
There you are, you see. If I give you a tiny clue, you can work it out for yourself.
Tungdil emerged out into the light. A veil of mist was slowly rising in the warmth of the sun.
Excellent cover for our climb, he said, signaling to the group to move faster.
We could be up there by nightfall.
Hardly. It's a difficult climb.
Balindar contradicted him.
The next stretch is notorious for snowdrifts, and we'll need to conserve energy. We've got an exhausting dash ahead of us with the Cordrian breathing down our necks.
Tungdil had not slackened his pace and was a considerable distance ahead. Iarhart assumed this was his way of showing that he did not intend to discuss his commands with anyone.
This mission is definitely going to be loads of fun.
He's going to get us all killed,
Balindar protested, starting to run. The rest followed suit.
Ah, many's the time we thought that in the past. But the scholar always found a way out,
Boindil reassured him.
And anyway, he's the High King. He's allowed to.
He showed his teeth in a smile to show it had been a joke.
And how many never returned? Asked Slynn.
But when he saw Boindil's face, he did not persist.
Charming, he murmured,
panting a little from the weight of his crossbow.
Vrakas, let me be one of those who make it back home again, muttered Slynn. In one piece.
As he ran, he grabbed a drink of water.
So what does the Cordrian do all day in the Grey Mountains? It's a pretty lonely, dead-end sort of place it rules over here.
It doesn't rule over anywhere,
snarled Balindar, who felt this was addressed to him.
It's a verminous pest infesting the area.
He pointed south toward Girdlegard.
From what we hear, it flies off to the Longans. After it's wiped out a few villages, the humans voluntarily put gifts of food out on the fields to keep it off their backs. The areas it's been targeting are in the former Goragar and in Urgon and Tabane. So it affects the Dragon Loha's brand as much as the Alfar and their vassals. But none of them dares brave the mountains to get to the Eyrie.
Slynn sniffed contemptuously.
Real heroes, then.
It's easier for everyone to wait and see when the Fifthlings will finish it off,
Iarhart added cynically.
I should be angrier, but since their cowardice may be a help to us, my fury has almost faded away. But only almost.
The Fourthling saw no sign of the beast.
Maybe Lohas Brand has made a deal with the Cordrian.
No,
contradicted Tungdil at the head of the column.
A Cordrian wants total dominance. It's just like a dragon, though with less mental capacity. Its size doesn't give it any advantage over a dragon because the scaled beasts are cleverer. The Cordrian has ordered its realm and feels at ease. Otherwise it wouldn't be nesting. It's content to eat without having to hunt. Lohas Brand, on the other hand, functions precisely like a typical dragon. Reigns like a king, exacting tribute from his subjects and so on.
Nice, charming, said Slynn peevishly.
But it's not right that all the monsters should end up coming to us from all over the shop just to enjoy an easy life.
Iarhart laughed.
I would love to see them all killed, and to celebrate, I'd sing an old song the drunkard Bavrigor taught me.
Bavrigor? Asked Balindar. The name rings a bell.
He was one of those who accompanied me, and never came back, said Tungdil darkly, speaking over his shoulder.
Is that enough of an answer?
The Fifthling, caught out, nodded.
Tungdil's grim expression was enough to spur the group on. He rarely said a word, and when he did, it was a command.
Under cover of the mist, they began their ascent to the Cordrian's cave, and by nightfall they had reached it. A hole in the cliff, 10 paces wide, yawned at them, an overwhelming smell of fresh, damp moss emanating from within. Iarhart held his crow's beak in his right hand and stared at the entrance.
You're sure it's not at home, scholar?
I wouldn't have urged you to hurry if it was. Whatever Balindar thinks of me, I wouldn't throw us all to the beast as a sacrifice.
The stars were faintly reflected in the gold of his eye patch.
Hang on. I've seen you fighting a Cordrian, and if you'd kept on, you'd have had him down,
Ireheart butted in. Tungdil took another deep breath. This one's different. I could tell from the way he's built his eyrie. Sometimes they just drop their eggs and leave the young to their fate. It's unusual to have an eyrie and a nest. And as for my little victory over a Cordrian, I can't surprise this one. It doesn't trust me. And it's been out of captivity for too long, living in the wild. We'd need a dozen or so of me if we wanted to beat this foe.
A dozen scholars? No wonder Belindis has had no luck.
Ireheart lowered his weapon and helped the others to haul their equipment up onto the narrow ledge. The sledges, cords, cables, and hooks, together with their provisions, were suspended on ropes they had anchored to the rock every few paces of their climb.
We won't find a better opponent for Lotionan, Tungdil agreed.
He waited until the other dwarfs had heaved up and secured their gear, then he spoke.
Eat now, then sleep till I wake you. After that, prepare to be on the run for orbits at a time. You'll get no more sleep until we've got a long way away from the monster. An enraged Cordrian can fly very fast.
He drew Bloodthirster.
I'll take first watch.
The dwarves looked at one another and went off to the sledges to shut their eyes for a while. With warm rugs of cat fur over them and bearded faces wrapped in scarves, they lay down to rest. They trusted their High King. Ireheart was unsure what to do. His legs were painful and as heavy as 10 sacks of lead shot, but on the other hand, he did not want to leave his friend, who had made the same exhausting climb in his peculiar armor, alone on watch. His eyes were tired and smarting, and he could hear his stomach rumbling.
I need something to eat first. Fracas, or my insides will be louder than a thunderstorm.
He went over to the sledge that held their food supplies.
Then perhaps a little smoke to aid digestion, and the world will look a whole lot better,
he muttered to himself. When he opened the first layer of leather to get at the bread, something caught his eye on the edge of the rock they had pulled themselves up over. He was surprised to see a metal retaining hook, shining and without rust. There was a dusting of snow on it. Hoarfrost would have made sense, but snow.
What does it mean?
He leaned over and brushed the snow aside. One glimpse was enough to tell him the hook was not one of their own.
Well, I'll be squashed flat with a hammer,
he cursed, rushing over to tell Tungdil what he had found. The one-eyed dwarf didn't want to come and inspect it. Instead, he turned on his heel and stormed into the cave. Ireheart followed him. The smell of moss grew stronger and became overwhelming, making it difficult to breathe. Ireheart lit a torch, intent on carefully examining what they found. What he saw caused him great concern. The Cordrian's brood had consisted of pale cocoons, each the size of a human, until identified intruders had turned up and slashed them to ribbons. Opaque, sticky liquid covered the floor ankle deep, almost frozen solid near the mouth of the cave. Dead and dismembered embryonic Cordrians lay among the mess.
So that's put pay to our great plan.
Ireheart squatted down to look at the corpses. They reminded him a little of flying fish, but they had more eyes and were 10 times as large.
What can have done it?
They were either mad or desperate. The same as us.
Tungdil stomped about the cave, bending over to examine individual body parts.
I should say there were 10 of them, with very sharp weapons. You can tell from the cuts, he imparted to his friend.
And the prince, say, dwarves. Belindis would never have kept it from us if she'd sent people out,
said Ireheart, moving through the carnage.
Despite all this slaughter, the overriding smell is still the moss. Could have been worse. Anyone who's
been covered head to foot with the stinking guts from an orc's slit belly, will know what I mean.
As he walked across to Tungdil, he surveyed the scene. The one-eyed dwarf yelled a warning at him.
No, don't! Don't what? Too late. You've trodden in it. Oh, it doesn't matter,
Ireheart gestured dismissively.
It's only moss. Perhaps Goda will like the smell.
It's not just her that will like it. The thing is, that smell will stick to your clothes, and to you.
The Cordrian will assume you killed his young,
Tungdil explained. Ireheart stared open-mouthed in distress.
Just me? What about you, scholar?
I didn't touch anything, and anyway, nothing sticks to Tionium. I can wash off any splashes, he replied. He examined the cave floor minutely.
There was an extra cocoon just here. They've taken it with them.
He rubbed his nose.
I wonder why.
Ireheart laughed.
Not the same reason as us, surely.
We'll have to find them to stop them doing something stupid. He pointed to the entrance. Wake the others and tell them. I'll check outside for tracks. He kicked one of the mutilated dead.
When they're grown, they're 10 times the weight of a warrior in full armor. If our thieves haven't taken to the skies, we'll find them and confront them.
They left the cave together, Tungdil to the right, Ireheart to the left. Boindil woke the troops and explained. As he was summing up, Tungdil came over.
I've found their tracks. They've climbed down on the other side of the mountain,
he informed them calmly.
We'll follow them and get the last of the Cordrian's offspring. They can give it to us voluntarily, or we can force them to hand it over. That cocoon is our only chance for a long, long time. The Cordrian needs at least 3 cycles before it's ready to lay again.
He looked at their faces.
It's vital nothing injures the outer casing. It would mean death for the young, and the parent would smell that at once. There'd be no more point in its following us. Except to pursue and slaughter its offspring's killers, thought Ireheart.
Slynn scowled.
Any idea who's stolen a march on us? It's almost as if our plans have been overheard. But who's behind this, and what's he planning to do with the cocoon? I haven't told them yet that we found dwarf boot prints, said Ireheart. Children of the smith?
Balandar gave a short, mirthless laugh.
Or small humans? Or gnomes and kobolds with stolen footwear playing a trick? Courageous kobolds?
Ireheart dismissed the idea.
Kobolds would never put themselves within 10 miles of a Cordrian. We'll soon see who we have to thank for this disaster.
Tungdil indicated they should break camp and stow their gear.
Boindil, you stay close to me from now on, came the quiet instruction. I don't need a nursemaid.
You'll need protection from the Cordrian. Even if he's stronger than I am, I can fight him off for long enough to give us a chance to escape.
I'm going to need you on this mission.
Tungdil was serious and honestly concerned for his friend's safety.
It is only the first of many, but all of our plans must work if we are to free Girdlegard and save it from the army gathering in the Black Abyss.
Ireheart swallowed hard. The inner chorus of doubting voices that had previously troubled him fell silent. Not a single one able to protest now against his conviction that his friend could be trusted. He nodded to Tungdil and followed him to the other side of the eyrie, where a broad set of tracks led to the steep slope. Tungdil surveyed the path the thieves must have taken.
What you make of that?
He asked.
I don't see the marks of any runners. So, have they used their shields to slide the cocoon down the mountain?
Ireheart raised his eyebrows.
Madness! They haven't abseiled. They've just slipped and slithered down.
He thought of the dwarf hater they had seen careering down the mountainside in the Outer Lands.
Could the Thirdling skirt wearers be behind this?
Tungtil looked at the other dwarves who were catching up with them now. Bearded faces with crystals of ice around noses and mouths, eyes sparkling with determination.
"Do you think we're brave enough to do what those thieves have done?"
His manner indicated, once more, that his questions were not questions, but commands. He took one of the sledges, pushing it off and jumping on board. Speeding over the edge, it was more a fall than a ride across the snow as he shot down toward the valley.
"How many usually die on his little missions?" muttered Slynn,
taking the leather band of his crossbow firmly in his hand. He shoved his own sledge downhill. Iahart was ahead of him, launching himself into the wild ride with a triumphant cry, "Vrakas!" After a few paces, picking up speed all the time, and with the strong icy wind bringing tears to his eyes, every bone in his body juddering and jarring, he knew one thing for certain. A lightning journey by tunnel car through the depths of the mountains was a princess's tea party compared to this.
Chapter 12. Girdlegard, Dwarf Realm of the Fifthlings, in the north of the Grey Range of Mountains, late winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. Tungdil stood at the edge of a snowy stretch of ground between two mountain slopes, completely at a loss. The tracks made by the cocoon thieves ended abruptly at the tips of his own boots. The prince disappeared at the edge of a precipice.
"They've climbed straight down the cliff."
He bent forward to spy into the depths. It was impossible to see the foot of the cliff.
"Must be at least 300 paces to the bottom. Can't make head or tail of it."
Balindar and Iahart were waiting at his side.
"Or perhaps they can fly after all," said the fifthling, checking overhead. "I can't make anything out on the rocks above us either."
Iahart searched around in the snow until he found solid rock.
"And there's no secret passage. I'd be able to hear it."
He noticed the funny looks the others were giving him.
"So? I just wanted to make sure."
Tungdil went a couple of paces to one side on the virgin snow of the plain.
"Not a bad idea."
He bent down and carefully brushed off the thin top layer of freshly fallen snow. In the older ice crystals underneath, there were clear marks of something being dragged.
"Clever of them," he acknowledged. "They've put a load of snow on one of the sledges, and they're using it to conceal their tracks. To make us think they've abseiled down the cliff, but in reality, they've gone this way."
With a grin, he gave the signal for them to march on.
"It's a good thing I'm here," joked Iahart. "If I hadn't checked for underground passages, we'd all have had to shin down the precipice on a bit of string. I'm a brainy dwarf, of course."
"If you say so." "They're heading east," stated Balindar. A thin layer of ice had formed on his mantle. Every time he moved, there was a rustling sound.
"If they keep on in this direction, they'll come to the Red Mountains. The path dates from old times, when the fast tunnels had been forgotten. The track hasn't been maintained properly by the tribes, and it's sure to be hard going. More a climb than a walk."
Iahart had another new idea.
"If they're planning to take the Cordrian's young off to Lohasbrand, perhaps it's a bunch of mini-orcs we're on the trail of. The dragons bred them specially small, so they can use our tunnels and narrow mountain paths. The Longans, of course, used to breed tiny dogs for going down badger sets and foxholes. Why shouldn't it work with orcs?"
"It's worrying, the things you come up with sometimes," said Balindar, surveying the plain.
"What would the dragon want with the cocoons?" "How should I know? To break the Cordrian's will and enforce his loyalty?"
The fifthling tutted, not even bothering to respond to that.
"If we head out across the plain, the enemy will be able to see us coming. Shall we hug the cliffs?" "We've not a grain in the hourglass to lose. Straight across," ordered Tungdil, setting off.
Iahart followed him at once.
"What about my theory, scholar?"
he urged with the eagerness of a young child. Seems obvious to me.
Possible, but not probable, replied Tungdil. Perhaps the Firstlings had the same idea as us and sent out a scouting party.
Playing the monsters off against each other to free themselves from the dragon's clutches and destroy the Cordrian, who'll have been weakened from the fighting?
Ironheart had a good long think.
Could be. But it's pretty odd they're putting the idea into practice at the same time as us.
The more he considered it, the less he liked his own theory.
Nonsense. They would have gone to see Belindis and asked for permission and support for the expedition. That's what you do if you're on someone else's territory.
Suddenly, Tungdil stood stock still.
Ironheart, Balindar Slynn, he whispered. Come with me. The rest of you, keep going to the other side of the plain, and wait for our signal.
He hurried off, bent low, going toward a cleft in the rocks that Ironheart and the others hadn't noticed.
It's a bit of a miracle, the way he finds things, said Slynn. I wouldn't have seen that till I'd walked into it. Vrakas has a soft spot for our scholar, laughed Boindil. It's always been like that as long as I've known him. Nothing's changed.
The little band stepped cautiously into the cleft in the rock. It was dark, but the air smelled fresh, not stale.
A tunnel, whispered Boindil. They probably won't have come upon it purely by chance. Whoever destroyed the nest and stole the cocoons, it's been a long time in the planning.
Tungdil led them along a sloping passage. They found crudely hewn steps leading further down. From below, they heard muffled voices.
We've got them, whispered Ironheart, full of anticipation. Let me go in first, scholar. I'll finish them all off. No one will escape me in these narrow. Pull yourself together, hissed Tungdil. Go on, let him, said Slynn softly. It's fine with me.
At that very moment, the Cordrian's screeching roar was heard outside. Wind shot through the tunnel, leaving them standing in whirling snowflakes. Boindil shuddered and remained motionless for a second before coming to his senses. He thought at once of the others in his party, who would be left facing the Cordrian on the plain.
May Vrakas be with them, he prayed. Let them find shelter before it gets to them. We need every man jack of them if we are to free Girdlygard.
He was about to put in his wax earplugs and go over to Tungdil, but his friend was already heading down the steps. There was no time to give support or employ caution. The Cordrian young had priority. The steps were old, crumbling away in places under their feet. Slynn lost his balance and was only saved by Balindar's presence of mind. Otherwise, he would have tumbled headfirst down the stairs.
"Shouldn't we go back to help the others?" asked the Fifthling. "They'll be killed."
"And so will we if we move out into the open without the cocoon," interjected Tungdil.
"And anyway, to the Cordrian, Ironheart smells like his offspring's murderer. We're no use if we fall in battle. The only ones to benefit would be our enemies. They will have to look to their own devices."
Finally, they reached the ground level and the passage became wider. They fanned out with Tungdil and Ironheart in the first row, followed by Balindar and Slynn.
"This leads due east," said Ironheart. "Our forefathers will have made the tunnel because they knew the high passes would not always be free."
Tungdil stopped abruptly, and Slynn cannoned into him. A loud and furious laugh swept through the passage.
"Ha ha 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 ha! They're sending out their heroes as if they had dozens more where they come from," came a deep voice. "The dwarf world will be hit hard by the loss. What will the tribes do without their figureheads and famous icons of bravery? Will the others emigrate? Commit suicide?"
Slynn bent and quickly lit two torches he had taken from his rucksack. He kept one and handed the other to Balindar.
"Come out of the dark, and I'll clobber your big mouth for you,"
Ironheart bellowed in rage.
"Are you a coward?" "No, I'm someone who likes the dark and knows it is his ally," the speaker replied. Why should I step into the light? You, come over here. Is there something wrong with your voice? You sound like a girl, shouted Aya.